Futures Radio Show, sponsored by CME Group, the world's leading and most diverse futures and options exchange. CME Group's markets help individuals and businesses around the world effectively manage risk. For access to free educational tools and resources for the active individual trader, please visit activetrader.cmegroup.com.
Every day, traders and investors dive in to tackle the ever-changing markets to find opportunity. Futures Radio Show is your number one source for answers to the questions that all market participants want to ask. Veteran futures trader Anthony Crudele sits down with the most influential leaders and top traders in the industry. Now, here's your host, Anthony Crudele.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in for this episode with Ed Lattimore. Remember, new shows are posted every Monday and Thursday. You can subscribe to our show on iTunes and YouTube. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a review on iTunes. Before I play today's interview for you, I want to give a shout out to the great sponsors of Futures Radio Show. CME Group, Trading Technologies, RJO Futures, and Top Step Trader. To learn more about these sponsors and the important things they are doing for futures traders, be sure to click on their logos on our website. Now, today I spoke with Ed Lattimore, heavyweight boxer, BA in physics, author, and speaker. Now, I bet many of you are wondering, why am I having a boxer on the show? Well, it's because I believe that traders and boxers actually have a lot in common, and I go over a lot of those commonalities in today's show with Ed. We talked about how a boxer develops their own style and strategy. We discussed the importance of learning fundamentals first. We talked about boxing coaches versus trading mentors, executing after getting punched in the face, and how to test yourself. Ed shares with us his struggles with alcohol and how he got sober. We discussed how Ed maintains a positive attitude and always keeps an open mind. So without further ado, let me take you right to the interview with Ed. Ed, thanks for joining me.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's really great to have you on the show, Ed. And I bet you a lot of people that are listening to the show are saying, Anthony, what are you doing having a boxer on a trading show? I compare a lot of what I do to a lot of things in life, but specifically to what a boxer does versus what a trader does. I think some of the basic things that each of us have is a strategy. And you have to then execute that strategy. I watch a lot of boxing, and you know I really enjoy watching Floyd Mayweather and how he has his strategy and how he works so hard in execution. Similar also with traders. We don't get punched in the face like you guys do, but we have losing trades. I've blown accounts, similar to getting knocked out. And you know, as someone like me who's blown a few accounts along the way, that has molded me into the trader that I am. And I'm going to make that assumption that you getting punched in the face has also helped you become the boxer that you are. So, you know, everything in trading is personal, and I believe it goes the same for boxers. I don't think there are any two boxers the same, just like I don't think there are any two traders the same. So can you talk to me about what you went through in building your own style and strategy as a boxer?
You know, I'm a big believer that you have to understand the fundamentals, that you need to know the rules before you can, you know, break the rules or bend them or modify them to fit your particular objective or style. So what I spent most of my career doing is learning how to fight. And it's amazing how long it takes to learn a thing. I always think back to what people say, like what a black belt represents in the martial arts, is that you are a great learner. You've stuck around long enough. You've learned all the basics. Now that you understand the basics, you can kind of move on to learn more advanced things. And that is how I built myself as a fighter, I spent time learning footwork, and I spent time learning how to punch and how to defend. And then when you learn these individual things, you have to bring them together and be able to execute them under pressure, under attack, with things in your face and under distraction. And this takes long. It's a long process. But as you continue with it, you don't give up. You learn from each endeavor, win, lose, draw. You become better, and some things you feel a connection with more for whatever reason. Maybe your coach delivered the lesson to you, or he had a particular style that he trained you in. Because what I've learned, and I don't know how this holds up in all disciplines, but certainly in boxing, the style many fighters develop is directly a result of the coach that taught them. And I don't mean that in that you know, the coach had a certain way of delivering the message and you picked it up. It's like, no, the coach only was aware of that style because like all things, right, there are great teachers and mediocre teachers and everything in between. And I think a mediocre teacher or even an average one doesn't realize that a foundation is more important than a particular style. Because if you have a good foundation, you can you know, get yourself out of a lot of problems, and you can solve a lot of problems that may not necessarily have a predictated response. But you really are on the fly doing these things and really having a great time, or as great a time as you can when you're dealing with somebody trained who's trying to hurt you and break you down. But that is how one develops a style, I think, in boxing, or how one develops the best way, whether everyone does this or not is somewhat irrelevant, but I think the best way to do it, and certainly the way I tried to do it, was I went and learned everything well. And only once I felt like I could do a certain thing, like we'll say in my sleep, for example, did I try to become creative or technically deviant, aka, you know, stylistically expressive.
A lot of things, I think, how this is similar to trading. And you, the first thing you said was learn the fundamentals. To me, that takes me back to the beginning of my career and learning about the basics of trading before you pick your strategy. What are some of the things that you did to study fundamentals? And, you know, did you do that on your own before you got a coach?
Oh, you know, it's funny you say that. I mean, for the first few months, maybe the first year of my career, I think I was just watching Mike Tyson videos, right? And this is with a coach, mind you, or at least in an environment with some structure. It wasn't until someone said, you know, your footwork is really terrible. And I didn't even know what that meant. Right. That's how much of an expert I was. That my first experience really sitting and breaking down a fundamental movement was with a coach named Chris Williams. And he looked and he said, your footwork is just, I mean, you no wonder you're having trouble. You can't do anything. You're never going to be in balance or in position. So we started. I mean, this must have went on. I remember it was cold in the gym, so it was probably in the winter. For a better part of 5 months, every day, we get together and it was these just drills. We just drill because it's like all things. If you drill until you're tired of drilling and then drill some more, you'll have it etched in your memory. It will be muscle memory, and it will be easy to recall. And most importantly, you won't have to think about it because you need to use that energy to think about the next thing to learn. So that is how I started. I mean, I didn't really have any – I knew what I wanted to be, right? Everyone has an idol. I don't know what the idol is in trading. Maybe it's that guy Livermore. That name sounds familiar. But I didn't have anything but that to go with. And it was only once certain coaches saw that I was serious, you know, it's really more important to get hit a few times and see, can you take the lumps? Can you take what this lifestyle is about before they really start to invest in you? Because I watched a guy, I always think about this story. I watched a guy win his first 8 amateur fights in really stunning fashion. And he went out there in his 9th fight. He not only did he lose, he got stopped, and he gets stopped. AKA, you know, TKO in amateur boxing, not in the heavyweight rank, is relatively rare. But he was not a heavyweight, and this happened to him, and he decided that boxing was no longer for him. That's an example of a guy who didn't have what it takes to progress in the sport. I don't even want to say good, but it's a painful sport. And if you can't endure that pain, what good is wasting all this time, you know, developing your technical abilities? I didn't get, you know, this technical education in footwork. I had lost a few fights by that time and had been hurt. So pretty much everyone knew, you know, I was game to fight and would be in there. So that's how that happened.
I want to talk more about coaches, and for us, that's mentors. I think that education in our industry is so important for the growth of our industry. But one thing that I see is that a lot of traders that are successful try to teach other traders the exact same method that they were successful with. So I go back to you as a coach, with your coaches. Did they allow you to be yourself when they were training you? Did they look at your strengths and weaknesses and help develop a strategy based upon that? Or did they try and teach you what they thought was a successful strategy?
So I'm really fortunate, man. You really picked a cool boxer to ask this question to, because not many boxers will have had as many coaches as I had because of a unique situation. Or really opportunity that presented itself to me as an amateur. So, you know, I've probably had or been around, had coached directly myself, six or seven guys, and been around at least a dozen. What I would say is that most coaches do try to mold you into a certain way, and if you can't pick it up, you know, you're the problem. Now, I've had also other coaches that are excellent teachers, and this is really important. When you're an excellent teacher, you can get away with this without many people knowing or noticing, because after all, you do have success translating your method to them or transmuting it, and then the fighter should have success if the coach is, you know, worth his soul, knows what he's doing. And you can really build some great systems out there. But I've had maybe one coach, I mean, my longest coach, who really went, no, that's not true. I would say two coaches, who one recognized my strength and really played and built around that. Another took the approach that I'm speaking of now, and then we developed and built what worked for me, which is he looked at where I was after we built fundamentals. We looked at where I was strongest and said, okay, this is where you need to be. This is what you need to do.
I want to talk about getting punched in the face and how you react to that. and I said at the beginning that that's like us losing a lot of money or blowing an account. And what we do from that moment going forward, I think, is what defines us as traders. Because for us as traders, we're all most likely going to have a big loss or blow an account at the beginning of our career. And it's just something that we've accepted. Just like a boxer goes into a fight and is most likely going to get punched really hard in the face. And it's what you do next, right, that defines you. So after you got punched in the face in the ring for, you know, one of your fights, how did you react and get yourself mentally focused again to go back to your strategy?
You know, this is just one of those testing points. Like, you know, do you have what it takes? Can you get hit and refocus and bring your, you know, get back to your strategy? How I did it personally, And some of this is my personality. I'm a very, very stoic guy. They had to push me to be fired up, and that's just not natural for the way I want to do things. But a lot of times you just have to remember that getting hit is part of the game. And if you're there long enough, or we'll scratch that, you won't be around long enough. Because your emotions will get the best of you, and you'll lose it, and you'll start seeing red or whatever, and it really just weeds you out. Boxing very much is a sport of kind of reduction. You know, guys do learn things, and they do progress with their knowledge, as knowledge should do, you know, moving forward. But there's also, you know, can you get hurt? Can you manage your adrenaline under fire? Can you think and take the information in that your coach is giving you in the corner when you're in an arena full of 1,000 people? You know, there are these things that are very, I don't want to say impossible, because I don't think anything is impossible to teach. I think some people have a much steeper learning curve than others, but I don't think anything is impossible to teach. But these things are so important to your development that if you don't have some type of predilection towards them, that will show and you will likely get beat out of the sport before you can express any type of mastery of the sport. Before you can be a good fighter, you're going to be a hurt fighter. You're going to be a discouraged fighter.
So you said that's a moment where you test yourself, and I've got a quick story for you. So I was running over the weekend thinking about what I wanted to ask you today. And, I live in Florida. I was running at 4:30 in the afternoon.
It
was
man. Very, very nice. What part of Florida? I'm just curious.
I'm in Naples, Florida.
Okay. How close is that to Sarasota? That's not close at all.
No, I'm about an hour south. About an hour. So it's basically like I'm living in almost the Caribbean here.
I go to Sarasota a lot. I'm a big fan.
Yeah, it's a great spot. And right now, this time of year, I think it was like 93 degrees, 100% humidity. And I love to run when the conditions are the toughest. I also like to run at the end of the day because a lot of times I'm mentally exhausted and it's hard to get motivated for me to want to do it. And I do this because I'm testing myself. And when you said that, I'm thinking to myself, that's exactly what I do. Obviously, you were in the ring and it was live. But prior to that, I'm sure you tested yourself in the ring and to see how you would react in a weak moment, right? And for futures traders, for all traders for that matter, we have weak moments when we're down our limits, trading bigger than we should be, just breaking our rules that we know we shouldn't be doing. So what I'm curious about is what you do prior to getting in that moment of weakness to train yourself what to do, how to be mentally prepared for that moment of weakness.
You simulate it as best as you possibly can throughout training via sparring. I mean, a good sparring set, no sparring session is ever going to emulate a fight, even one with genuine malice for whatever reason. Two guys in the gym don't like each other. It doesn't emulate being underneath the lights, elevated above the arena. You know, a referee that is more, the referee's not your friend. You know, he's in there really for two reasons: to make sure you don't get hurt to the point where they're going to sue, because you know, because the rules aren't followed, and to make the fight continue. So you don't have these things during sparring, but you can get very close, and you can just keep pushing and training, and that's what training's for. Is so much for like how you build that up even further. To you get in as many different situations as you can, you know, that's why. And you get in these situations on the fight, but you don't want to lose the fight when you get into these situations, but you want to be developed. So we call in boxing, you know, you're developing a fighter. You're putting them in with tougher and tougher competition each time. Competition, he should win. Now, you know, there are all kinds of opinions about this, but the sport is what it is now. And now, you know, a guy with some money and some backing, they're going to make sure they develop that fighter. Because, you know, you get money and backing after you've proven yourself in any number of ways, whether that be with a stellar amateur career or an upset over someone as a professional who you weren't supposed to beat, but you went out there and did beat. So you get this support. And this support helps you. It puts you in the ring. They go, okay, this guy, he's good with this, and this. He's not so good with that. He's going to be a tough test, but our guy should beat him. And you just keep getting these tests until you ideally make it to the point where you're fighting for some type of title. But the test, that's really a cool thing about boxing, in my opinion, is that you can prepare. But that preparation, I mean, it's just not... Even though I'll give you a really basic example of how it's just not the same as being in a live fight. In sparring, they call them sparring gloves. Sparring gloves, you know, they're not going to be any bigger than, or smaller, I should say, smaller than like 14 ounces. And that's like if you're in there with like some real killers. Usually sparring gloves are 16 ounces and you don't have a full professional hand wrap on, which is effectively a cast. In a fight, though, and so as a result, you don't hit as hard, and you don't get hit as hard. So there's no way to really prepare for, like, what that impact is like when you have full fight gloves on, which are only 10 ounces, that 10 ounces is distributed in your wrist. So there's just more exposure for your fist, or less of a barrier between your fist and the object you're hitting, the face, a body, a rib, whatever. And then the wrap that you put on for a fight, I mean, yeah, they have rules to make sure it's not like a full-blown cast. But nah, man, this is dangerous. I mean, it's very dangerous. We don't even call it a sport, really. We call it a hurt business. So that's where that preparation comes in, is that you just try and get as close to the conditions as you possibly can, and hopefully you get to get a slower and slower introduction to the big time.
Yeah, that reminds me a lot of what traders do while they're in simulation mode versus live. You can't replace that adrenaline that goes on during a live time when you're risking real money. I want to take this a little bit more to current day with you. You're not boxing anymore. So someone like you who's used to training, used to testing yourself, now you're in business. Like for me, that's why I go out on those runs during those times. Like I want to be in a weak moment to see if I could follow through finishing the run. If I'm too tired, how am I feeling at that moment to push through? I also do a lot of meditation now to help me in real life situations. Are you doing anything these days to test yourself?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I'm of the opinion that people like us, it's innate. I mean, obviously, I think anybody with the proper training can be made to do a thing. Now, whether they can get into the top 20% or 10%, that is where the limits of this thing called talent, is, and whether it decides. But I think the people who tend to be successful at this kind of stuff, that this high pressure, all or nothing, there really is no second place kind of deal. I don't think that ever goes away. All right. I think that's just part of our personalities. So for me right now, I don't have that outlet anymore in terms of a physical space. So what I've started to do, I've really got into competitive chess, very heavily, I got an official rating now that's climbing, and I play on the team for my city on fourth board, and I'm getting better and better, and it's really fun to push myself mentally. And I had a choice. I looked and I said, okay, I can do chess or I can do Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I said, I know myself, I'm not going to just do a little Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We're pretty much going to go full time like we did with boxing and see how far we can get. And I didn't want that kind of burden because I'm trying to do other things in my life right now. But I knew that's what I would be walking into. So I went along with competitive over the board chess, and I'm having a great time with that. As far as the training for my body, though, I still got to find ways to push because there's not. You can't replace boxing training with anything else. There's nothing like it. That's why boxing exercise is like such a big the rave now, because done properly. I mean, look, I was easily burning 3,000 calories a day. I mean, I could eat. And I was doing this. I mean, I'm ashamed to say I could eat a whole box of Ritz crackers and lose weight throughout the week. I was working that hard. Well, now not only do I have to exercise more discipline when I eat, that's actually the easy part. The hard part is working that hard, because it just doesn't feel useful if I go do the kind of workout that I need to do. Doesn't feel like a workout because I'm so used to past 11 years, everything is just crazy runs, and so that I think that's why I'm drawn to like chess, is that it's even more objective and it's still a bit of a battlefield. And why my workouts, I have to make them challenging, because to be normal, to do what other people would do, even though it would work, is not satisfying to me. There's also the element of standing out that I think if you don't have it when you go into boxing, you will have it if you stick around for any reasonable amount of time, because that's one of the things that happens. You end up, even at a local level, as the focus of attention.
Something that I think that traders and athletes also have in common are the struggles that they go through to achieve success. But I think not talked about nearly enough is the struggles in sustaining success. For me, I've learned that sustaining success as a trader was actually harder for me mentally than achieving success. For me, once I had some success as a trader, made a little bit of money, got a little comfortable, all of a sudden I was losing again. I made many, many mistakes and found out really the hard way that I had to adapt even after I had figured out my strategy. So did you find in your career as a boxer and even after boxing now in business that sustaining success is just as hard or even harder than achieving success?
In many, many, many ways, yes, because success is very comfortable. And once you get comfortable, especially, you know, if you attain that comfort through something very challenging and very painful and that requires such a huge investment in time, I always joke, I say in the next life, I'm going to be a musician so I can drink and party with the fans, because there's none of that in boxing. When you and I really think anyone who wants to perform at the top level in their respective skill or ability, they don't want any distraction either. So you really got to zero in and focus. So you focus and you push so hard and you finally have a breakthrough and you're like, man, I want to enjoy some of this. The problem is you can't enjoy some of it, because that is what the people who are unsuccessful do. You're successful because you've done all of this, and it becomes more tempting the more successful you are to indulge in your successes. You know, in boxing, I worked very hard, and I had some great breaks. One as an amateur, I got trained in Los Angeles with a paid sponsor. And then as a professional, I got a promotion contract relatively early in my career. And you know, with the promotion contract, I didn't feel as complacent. I'll say that. But with the amateur contract, I was like, wow, you know, once I felt like I was in and I had made it, you know, I started drinking even heavier, and I didn't really know anybody in LA to party with, but I wanted to just relax. I wanted to spend all my time kind of hanging out in this apartment. I would remind myself that, you know, this apartment, you got all this because of training, you got to go train. And I think that's what a lot of people forget when they get to a certain level of success. It's like, you have this success precisely because, you know, you were able to shut out a lot of nonsense and get your head in the game. Once your head gets out the game, you want to have a good time and party, you know, not work as hard, think you're above it all. That happens a lot too. You know, guys start to believe their own hype, and so they don't think they need to put in the same amount of work that they did coming up, when the reality is you got to put even more. But when guys start to think this way, it's not long for their success. They will certainly fall off and fail sooner than later. And so I had to battle that and keep my motivation taut and really focus on a process, a thing I could control. Could I become good? Could I do X, Y, or Z better? Because if I first of all, in boxing, it wasn't even that much money, but the little bit I had, it was certainly an elevation from where I was. And if I let myself get overindulged than that, then I would not have that money for very long, because I would lose.
You went through a struggle with alcohol. You're sober now. And I personally have known many traders over the years that suffer from alcohol abuse. And I think, even to this day, a lot of traders, even though we're not in the pit anymore, they go right to drinking after trading on a regular basis. And in my opinion, this is a big problem that's not being addressed in our industry. So can you talk to us about your struggles with alcohol and what you did to get yourself sober?
I'm coming up on my fifth year sober. Well, it'll be 5 years in December. And really, my reasons for drinking is, you know, for me, it wasn't so much a catharsis. It wasn't like I need to blow off some steam. I say, you know, alcohol takes the shape of whatever you feel like you lack in your life. And for me, I felt like I didn't have any companionship. I didn't feel like I was likable. I had to find a way to make people like me. So I figured if I drank a lot, and really it made me just feel likable. It took the pressure off of me to interact socially, because I could always, you know, just say I'm having a drink, and I was able to lean on that, just find other drinkers. And pretty soon, you know, you do a thing to get an, you know, you have an action to get some kind of reaction. I drink to feel better. But after a while, you know, in a very Pavlovian sort of way, you can't tell the difference anymore. Now you are drinking to get to feel good, or do you only feel good when you drink? I couldn't tell. And really, it just took over my life. And everything was about, if there wasn't alcohol, I didn't want anything to do with it. Whether it was a social obligation or a familial one, I wanted everything to be about alcohol. I embarrassed myself on multiple occasions. There were even times I tried to show up to the gym, you know, with a little bit of alcohol. Not to the gym with the actual contents, but like I call it doing the math. And when you start doing the math, you know, you're in trouble. And I was trying to do the math to figure out how long before practice I could have a drink and then be able to function. I was trying to leave the gym early so I could get to the bar, you know, for happy hour specials. It really, and remember, it's not like I have a lot of money at this point in my life either. It's another kind of sign I knew something was bad is that, you know, becoming a better person was taking a backseat to alcohol. And in many ways, for example, you know, I wanted to make sure I was able to take the little bit of money I had and go spend it and drink. And so at this point, you know, what am I at this point? 27 is 28. I remember how I brought my 28th birthday in. So yeah, 27, 28 kind of deal. You know, that was the last year I drank, in 2013. But here's the thing about this and how I got it under control. First thing is I changed my environment. And this was really an accident. I needed some money because I wanted to go back to school. And so I enlisted in the military. And between basic training and my AIT, I did 22 weeks away from my, the social life that I had known, right? And in this 22 weeks, I managed to get a drink one time. We snuck off base and went to a movie. And then at the movie, we poured some alcohol and drinks and stuff. And I remember when I got back, I went out and partied one time with my friends when I got back. And I said, you know, I just weighed it all out. I was like, I got something to live for now, really. And that's weird to even put it that way, but it's true. I felt like I had something to live for beyond myself. I'm like, all right, so I'm trying to finish school. I'm in the military now. I just met this cool girl, and I'm trying to, you know, develop my boxing career. And I wanted all of these things to work out. At the very least, I was going to push them as far as they could go, and I didn't want any excuse for them failing. At least no excuse that, you know, that could be, you know, attributed to, like, something I could have easily not done, which is drink. And so that's what did it. It was a combination of having a really strong why. You know, I had those things going on. And I didn't want to be the person I was leaving behind, because the person I left behind before I joined the military. And anyone listening, you know, I don't want to paint the picture like the military whipped me into shape. What the military did for me, certainly in basic training, is it left me alone with my thoughts for the first time, maybe it, at least as an adult, for sure. I can't remember if it was a kid, you know, at all. But it left me alone with my thoughts. And I was able to really reflect on where my life was going and how I felt and why I did certain things. And when I got out, I said, I'm not going to get where I want to be because of my relationship with alcohol. So now I tell people, I go, look, man, as far as I'm concerned, I have forfeited the right to alcohol in this life, because I can't even imagine going back. Now I've made not drinking cool in this weird way. So, like, you know, and I've got a book coming out about that later this year, about the transition from being, you know, an alcoholic to being sober, because many signs are present, and it really took a while for me to go, look, man, I got a problem. I'm an alcoholic. I got to figure this out, because my drinking is impeding the progress that I want to make in my life. Regardless, you know, however, whatever definition you use, at the end of the day, if a thing is keeping you from becoming better or becoming who you want, then you have a problem. You have a really bad relationship, and you have to break up with it. So that's my story in somewhat of a nutshell.
Well, I can't thank you enough for sharing that. I think it's extremely important that people hear stories like that. And, you know, I follow you on Twitter, and you're a very positive person. I only know you really through Twitter. So most of what I see of what you put out there, you're a glass full kind of guy, half full kind of guy. Right. And I've learned for myself that being positive, really, no matter what life throws at me, is just better for my well-being and for my business. Have you always had that positive attitude, or did you have to learn how to be positive?
What I have always had is you know, I don't just accept situations. I like to try and solve problems. I believe that you can work through, even when I had no confidence in myself and my abilities, I always imagined that one day I'd be able to be better, right? I've always had an imagination and this interest in solving problems. As far as, you know, whether I've been positive my whole life, well, at some point, I think just, you know, looking to reinforce my strengths, learning and reading about, like, what makes a person a better problem solver and what makes a life even less stressful. Because of, and that's the other thing, I'm like, you know, on the whole Big Five personality test, I'm a zero in neuroticism. I mean, I'm a really, it's got to be a bad situation for me to freak out. And even then, I'm like, okay, let's solve it. Like, so that's just how I learned that you can be even better at that with a positive attitude. And then, like, on top of that, I mean, I'm so grateful. A lot of times I just walk around and I look at the position my life is in, and I know where it was, and I remember where I was born, and I think about all of these things. And I go, man, I'm just super grateful to be here, right? I can't even imagine. Like one of the things I'm big at talking to people about on Twitter is, you know, don't waste your time arguing with people and fighting and whatever. Because me personally, you know, I'm so grateful to be here. I'm like, why would I waste this precious time arguing and trolling on social media? An invention is just beautiful. I want to use it to add some more beauty to my life. I was talking to a friend of mine I had lunch with before we got on the call, and we were talking about the whole situation with Brett Kavanaugh. And in my perspective, I don't care, you know, who did it or didn't do it or what. I'm just like, look, man, how is me caring about this going to make my life better? You know, I got 80 years, maybe 90 on this planet if I'm lucky. And why would I waste any moment really devoting a lot of energy to this? And this is, you know, my whole perspective about many things in the media comes from, as I look and I go, look, man, I have 80, maybe 90 years, and I really don't want to waste any time. I wasted enough time in my 20s, you know, chasing booze. I'm trying to, like, make the most of every day and not let anything kind of take up residence in my mind that I'll have to devote energy towards. And devoting energy will cost me time, and it will cost me enjoyment. So that's where my whole positive mentality comes from. I feel like it's just a more efficient way to live.
Yeah, I want to stay on a lot of the things you do on Twitter, and something you talk a lot about, and you just briefly mentioned it, is the inability for people in our society to have rational discussions, agree or disagree. I see so much more of that. I primarily am on Twitter for financial Twitter, FinTwit, and it's just amazing how people take every single thing so personally now, and they can't have a rational discussion. And you talk a lot about this, and you're a big advocate for having an open mind. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, that's the only way I can learn. I mean, I'm only here. We're only having this conversation because somewhere along my life, or rather multiple times, but really, if we want to look at one action that I think has made the biggest difference, is that I continue to learn, and when I learn, I try to use that to improve the quality of my life. So it's really important for me. You know, I keep an open mind to the point where, like, to where I just want to hear what other people say. I'm not going to degrade them for their thought processes. You know, as long as I always say, if you lead with respect, you will get respect right back, because we can't we can't claim to be adults and have conversations if we can't even, you know, have doing with basic human decency. And also, man, I think a lot of people forget there's a human on the other side of that screen, whether that's an avatar, you know, there's a person typing it. I never forget that, you know, and I try and treat that person as if we were standing face to face. And I think that's one of the great benefits anyway of not being any kind of anonymous and having a relatively large platform on social media, is that, you know, I could be a, right, and then I have to do it, possibly running into people or whatever. And I always say, you know, it would crush me if somebody who I spent money on turns out to be an a-hole to me or whatever. Right? I don't need that. So I never want people to feel like I'm like I'm a negative source of energy. You know, that's just not good. And one of the best ways to prevent that is to approach every person as if they can teach you something. At the very least, you're wrong, right? Our worst case scenario, you're wrong. They can teach you nothing, and the conversation ends. But look, if you start arguing with fools, man, somebody who walks by, they can't tell the difference between who's the fool and who was the one that got instigated with. You know, that was the point I made to my buddy today. I'm like, look, I'm not going to get into any of these debates because, one, I understand that these debates are not nuanced conversations. They're not rational discussions. They're between people who have decided that their interpretation and reasoning or a way of seeing the events is correct and yours is wrong, and there's no middle ground. It's all absolutes. So if I get into any of these discussions, no matter what side, if I get into anyone and take them seriously, because I understand how each person is entering the discussion with mindset, then what does that make me? That no matter how intelligent I approach it, right, that makes me a fool, you know? No matter how good of a driver you are, man, if you got wheels with no tread, good luck on a wet road. You know, that's how it is. You know, the road is wet out here, and nobody's got it. No one's got a mind with some tread on it. That's the thing. I'm not trying to get involved in any of this. I just want to be, I want to use this to help. That's all. And I really believe this is going to be a really weird thing to say, but I don't have another way to put it because of my, the little bit of mysticism and things of that nature I've studied. I really feel like, you know, the internet and Twitter, man, they're like gifts from the gods, man. They want to see what they're going to do with this. Are they going to destroy each other? Or are they going to, you know, come together? You ever see the movie Arrival? It's one of my favorite movies. And the whole premise is that these aliens show up and they put these like spaceships in different places around the world, and they have a special language, and if you figure it out, now they don't notice, but if you figure it out, you know, it gives you the ability to to move backwards and forwards through time as if it's like a regular dimension. But the only way you can figure it out, you got to work together, right? So to me, that's a beautiful kind of story. And I think it's analogous to what's happening on Twitter. Here we have a tool that allows us to instantaneously connect with anyone around the world. And I always make the argument that the old networking system is dead. I mean, I have people in my DMs, you wouldn't believe, high ranking members of the White House, to athletes, to actors that I regularly, man, I'm a kid from the projects, man. Like, there's no reason why I should have this level of access to people, and anyone can do that. It's a powerful tool. Are we going to use it to improve minds? Are we going to use it to wall ourselves off and become even more tribal than we were before we effectively demolished the borders, which is how I view the internet. If it effectively demolished, I mean, I can sit, if I was a video gamer, I could sit here right now, get on my Xbox Live or whatever that is that kids are using today, and play somebody in Russia. You know, I've never been in Russia, but I can, at the speed of light, say, what's up, man?
Yeah, it's crazy. And you do have a great attitude on Twitter. And I want to go to some of your tweets, actually, and have you talk a little bit about them. I picked two that I found to be very interesting and wanted to hear a little bit more about them. And one of them is, you said, the greatest hustle of our generation is college education. It has managed to increase in cost while decreasing in value.
Oh yeah, and you know, remember, I'm a guy with a freaking who went back to school, and got a degree in physics, which is no slouch subject, man. That's a hard degree to get. And here's my opinion of college. You know, and some people got it, some people didn't, some people read it in their own bias for or against. The bottom line is this: if everyone has a college degree, then a college degree is just worth less. That's not anything magical. You know, remember, there was a time in this country where having a college degree pretty much guaranteed you, you know, at the very least, a middle-class lifestyle. It's not too bad, right? But that's because most people didn't have college degrees. It was a rare thing. Gone are the days where it was, you know, gone are the study whatever you want and you'll get a job, you know, days. And that's cool, right? I'm a big fan personally of more people needing actual skills as opposed to just certification. The issue is, and this is why where that tweet comes from, the issue is that the cost of university in this country has skyrocketed. You know, you can't. I remember. I think it was my dad. One time we were kids talking about how he worked through college. If my dad was alive today, I would make fun of him for that statement. I'm like, good luck trying to work and pay this off. It's insane. People with full time salaries, because they let you defer loans, right? Can't pay it off. What do you think a kid who can work, you know, maybe 10 hours a week can do? So really, that's where that comes from. I mean, now literally having a degree overall is just worthless. Obviously, there are still some undergraduate degrees which are really valuable. I mean, anything, not all STEM. I think the T and the E of STEM, the technical and the engineering, they're very valuable. And professional degrees, you know, MD, JD, things of that nature, are very valuable as well. But most of the other ones, yeah, you know, those, and that drags the value of the whole institute of college way down. You know, you can't have a few things that are worth like $80,000, and you can only get those jobs with prior education in that field, and then a bunch of other things that pretty much guarantee you a $12 an hour job as a barista. It's not good for the economy, especially when it costs so much to get.
The next tweet I want to talk about is where you said, before you can make any meaningful changes in your life, you have to believe that you're capable of such a transformation. Sadly, too many people have accepted that they are forever doomed to be subpar and mediocre. This is not true, but only if you believe it.
Oh, man. You know, that's heart, man. I mean, I wrote it, obviously, but like, it just, it really speaks to, so I see a lot of people, right? Okay, so I'll just use myself, my surroundings as an example. I am not the same person I was at 27, not even close. There is not a single metric in my life that says this is the same guy that basically had no real future unless he became a great boxer. No, that guy's dead. And over the course of five or six years, in his place is who I am now, a completely different person. I don't see many people make such a transformation, for better or worse. It's just wherever they get stuck is where they get stuck. And I think what happens, because change is just such an energy intensive or extensive process. I mean, you really have to put a lot into changing who you are. I mean, I'll tell you firsthand, it was not easy, but it was worth it. But I think many people look at it and go, it's not easy and it's not worth it. How much more difficult or how much better can my life can be? And the answer is a hell of a lot better, especially the lower you get. But if you don't believe that, why would you even change? And this is not just monetary. I mean, this is everything from the quality of the relationships you have to your health. You know, you can be whatever you want to be. Not whether you'll be great at that is, you know, that's the detail-oriented person in me. But you can be whatever you want to be, and it really just takes some time. But if you don't believe you can do it, if you don't believe you can change, you're not going to try. I just posted this picture on Facebook. I got my high school grades because I wanted to make a point for a presentation. And the point I was making is that I barely graduated high school. I was a horrible math student, right? I had no confidence in my ability to learn math. But when I said, okay, I'm going to go back to school because I don't have any earning prospects and I don't want that to be my life, I looked online and I said, okay, what are the best jobs? They all had math. Looks like I got to get good at math. So for almost a year before I left for the military, and then after, I just continued doing problems, and I said, I'm going to prove to myself I can learn this. I'm just going to keep putting the work in, and it paid off. It paid off because not only did I get the physics degree, now I have the best side job in the world. I go tutor, 4 to 6 hours, not a day, more like 10 to 15 hours a week. I get to tutor for $50 an hour and the high school students in physics and calculus and all these things that most people, not only if they're good enough at it, they don't have the personality to really engage a person. And I'm fortunate that I got to be put in that position, but I got to be put in that position because I didn't accept that I had a D average in mathematics in high school. I didn't accept that. I didn't believe that was who I was. Just like when I was 22 and I decided to box, I didn't accept that was too old to start boxing. You know, you can really be whatever you want to be, but you have to imagine you can do it. And people either lack the imagination or they lack the follow through.
Last question before we go on to rapid fire. On Twitter, you've talked about FinTwit and traders in a positive manner. What do you think the public can learn from traders to add more meaning and success to their lives?
Emotional discipline and an understanding of risk, because people have zero. I'm imagining, from what I see anyhow. I'm not a trader, but from the guys I see and what I understand of success, particularly in something that deals with uncertainty, there needs to be a certain level of discipline. If for any other reason, then you need to be to follow a system rather than your emotions. You need to make objective decisions in the face of what you feel, which is always difficult regardless of what your feel is. It just so happens that you guys, have to do it quite often. I think if more people could look at things
and collectively as a whole, you know, obviously there's going to be some fools. I mean, intelligence is still normally distributed, but if we can kind of move that average, you know, to the right and increase the overall intelligence and rationality of our fellow humans, I think that would go a long way. And one of the best ways to do that is to stay committed to finding the fact and the reality of the situation, regardless of how said situation makes you feel. That's the first thing. The second thing, the understanding of risk. I think people have a generally poor understanding of risk and uncertainty. And then maybe I ended up with maybe a little better one because of a combination of poker and all the math we have to take as physics majors, including two semesters of probability and statistics. And that really, because I always learn things best by relating them to reality and just seeing how things work. And how I can not just have this exist as an abstract concept, but really something tangible that perhaps I can reach out and touch in the world. And so I see that, and I know that the world is really lacking that. People don't understand, for example, the difference between a deterministic and a probabilistic statement, and they wonder why generalities piss them off. Now, part of it is, you know, the dog that barks is the one that was hit when we made a comment on, like, Twitter. But the other part is people just don't understand that, you know, if you find an exception to a rule, that does not mean the rule is incorrect in the sense that we say rule in that statement. That's what you should do. You should be able to find an exception. Otherwise, you know, then we'd have something. Then we'd have a law. So, people, you guys do a great job with this. Basically moving in the realm of uncertainty and risk and understanding its implications and remaining disciplined in the face of these choices you have to make where the right decision is not necessarily obvious.
Love it, man. Love this conversation today, Ed. This was awesome, but we're not done yet, my man. We have some rapid fire questions if you're ready for those.
All right, let's go. Rapid fire.
All right, everyone. Our rapid fire segment is sponsored by Trading Technologies. Access the global markets from virtually anywhere with TT. They are the world's fastest commercially available futures trading platform. And now you can trade cryptocurrency spot and derivative markets side by side. For more information, please visit tradingtechnologies.com. Ed, first question, who has influenced your life the most and why?
Oh man, the most. Oh, that's a good question. I'm going to say people from no one in particular, but a lot of people I've grown up around. As you know, as a kid, the really bad influences who I didn't want to be, and then as a young adult, some of the better influences that I got to see, I wanted to be like. I can't think of any one human where I'm like you. You greatly influenced me. I really like Richard Feynman, though. He's a great, if I'm going to go like who, at least recently, the way he prides himself on being able to understand and explain things to people, I want to be that way. I want to be a good teacher.
Is boxing, poker, or chess the best analogy for life?
I think they all have their place. If I had to lean on one and one analogy only, I would. Chess is out. So, you know, I'm going to go with boxing because getting hurt is part of life, and you pick yourself up and you got to continue going. Though I really do like the uncertainty of poker. I think that emulates more of life than getting punched in the face. But recovery from damage will always happen. And so boxing is a pretty good analogy.
What was one of the hardest things that you've had to overcome in your boxing career?
Probably not having any backing. I didn't have any backing as an upcoming pro. I couldn't find any fights as an amateur because there was no one local around here. So I had to figure out how to get good without the necessary, you know, without a lot of people around to make me good. And I also had to drive a car that wasn't inspected and it didn't have insurance. I was really, you know, driving dirty, as they say, but it was because I wanted to train with the best coach around and it really paid off.
How has your daily routine evolved over the years?
Now I'm a much bigger advocate of sleep. Before, especially over the past 5 years, I had kind of prided myself on being an early riser and also being able to stay up late. Now I think I think those are not good habits for health. So I'm a big fan of sleep. I'm a big fan of cooking my own meals, and I don't watch almost any television. I try to listen to a lot of good music. I don't listen to the radio either. That's another thing that's really changed. I listen to classical music or podcast.
What is one attribute that you believe every athlete, chess player, trader, or poker player should have?
Grit. I think grit is the word for it. You pretty much gotta take your lumps and keep moving forward. They say 90% of success is showing up. The way I've interpreted that is if you can keep getting up and keep making it through, you're going to be all right. And the people who don't do that, those aren't going to be your competition. They're going to drop off, and you're going to be left only with the top few people, and you're really going to have a lot of success if you can just keep showing up.
Favorite book you've read lately?
I haven't read that much. Oh, no, I have. My favorite book lately is Skin in the Game by Nassim Taleb.
What's the best piece of advice you've received about being a boxer?
A good friend of mine said, you should put down the bottle for like the rest of your career and see how far you can go. And I ended up taking that advice, and now I never want to pick it up again.
If you could go back in time and give the younger you a piece of advice, what would it be?
Don't drink would be the number one.
Last question for today, Ed. What's your favorite thing to do when you're not working?
I love watching movies. I got the whole Cinemark. I have the Cinemark movie pass, man. I'll probably go to the theater once a week. I got a lot of streaming. I have a Fire Stick we just got. But I don't sit around watching it. So, I mean, that's my unwind, man. I like movies. The only hobby I have is movies. Everything else has a competitive element to it.
There's something said about going to the theater. I don't think a lot of young people enjoy it the way that we did when we were younger. I mean, for me, it was like, well, that's all we did. And we used to love to go to the show. I think nowadays with Amazon and Netflix, it's taken away from that whole experience.
Oh, yeah, man. I love popcorn, and it's fun. I'm a big, big fan. I try to go once a week.
Ed, where can people find you on Twitter, and give us a website to check out?
My Twitter is Ed Lattimore, just at Ed Lattimore, and my website is the same thing, www.edlattimore.com. And those are the places I'm most active. I hope you sign up for my mailing list or follow me on Twitter. I'd love to have you. I'm the most polite guy on the internet, I like to say. So,
everybody, you absolutely have to follow Ed on Twitter. I mean, Ed, it really is an honor to know you, my friend. I want to thank you for coming on Futures Radio Show today and speaking with me. I had a lot of fun.
Hey, thanks for having me, even though I'm not your typical guest.
Thank you for listening to Futures Radio Show. If you have any questions or comments for myself or my guests, please visit futuresradioshow.com and sign up to be a premium member for free. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes.